These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
It's the Mother's Day time of year. So today we're going to celebrate moms by talking all about motherhood. How does mothering look today compared with what it looked like, say, 20 years ago, 100 years ago? How about during Egyptian, Sumerian, ancient Greek, and medieval times? Well, we'll seek those answers this hour. Also on the program today, we explore the Zen of motherhood and find out about young mothering in Alaska. That's Kids These Days today. Hi, I'm Shanna Sheehy, the host of Kids These Days. Today, it's a Mother's Day edition of our show. Why not celebrate some of your favorite mom stories by sharing them with the Kids These Days community? It's easy to do. Post comments to our Facebook page or to our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. Do it now and share that with us. Today's guest joins us from WBUR in Boston. Shari L. Thur is the author of The Myths of Motherhood: How Culture Reinvents the Good Mother. Shari is a psychoanalytically trained psychologist in private practice, and she lives in Boston, Massachusetts. And I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today, Shari.
And thank you so much for having me.
Well, I read your book, and it was a great read. And I'd like to start our discussion today, actually, with paraphrasing something that you state in your book, and so I'm quoting you here. You say, the way we perform mothering is culturally derived. Our current ideal of the mother is, like all ideals, culture-bound, historically specific, and hopelessly tied to fashion. I think that's a great place to start. Maybe you can unravel that for us and explain it some.
Sure. Well, our idea of what a good mother has varied tremendously over time, and very much with the advent of birth control, so that people are able to choose whether they have children or not. But the way we parent has changed. I mean, people today do attachment parenting, or some people are very much into rules and strictness and accomplishment, and all of that flip-flops. So depending on where, you know, on your values and really what era you're living in. So that when I had my child, the idea of being empathic was very important, that you had to tune in to your child at all times. And if you didn't, your child could become mentally ill. And all problems were therefore caused by mom, bad mothering. But today, I think there's less focus on that. And now so many problems are thought to be genetic, biological, autism, for example.
So you see that as yet another shift? Because I know when you wrote...
I see that as a great shift, yeah. Moms are not so much blamed these days for psychological problems.
And you do go into that in your book, in fact, about how at some point in our history, there's this shift that leads to... all of a sudden, you know, mothers are empowered, but they're seen as empowered to do harm to their children.
Exactly.
And I think you talk about...
exactly. It's a double-edged sword.
Right, exactly. Well, I really want to get to that, but I kind of feel like this conversation could be best played out if we sort of start at the beginning. You and your book start at the beginning. You travel back thousands and thousands of years, and you start to take a look at some of the first mothers and have some ideas there about what parenting might have looked like. Could you start by telling us about that?
Well, I guess if we go back even to pre-literate times, that people didn't even understand that what caused pregnancy. I mean, it might be, it took thousands of years to understand that sexual intercourse might result in pregnancy. The two things weren't related, you know, having a baby pop out. And people thought things varied by the moon and the sun and so forth and so on. But once I made the connection and the ideas of the gender power structure happened and women became, because men could have so many children, women became very responsible for taking care of children, and sort of gender roles evolved and developed and were reinforced in various cultures. So I think the biggest change was the discovery, the connection between how babies were born, why they were born.
Right. So let's go back to before that connection was made. So we're talking about, groups of people who, you write in your book that women were really seen as, in a way, as awesome. Well, this is all sort of speculative, like how people
believe,
people thought of it. But, if you don't associate the coupling of a man and a woman with the birth of a child, then, women just all, become bigger, and then all of a sudden they give birth, and
this miraculous thing. Absolutely, yeah.
Right.
So that was a form of empowerment and grandeur and grandiosity and so forth.
And you researched how, people suspect that the goddess, the goddess figurines and so forth in prehistory, maybe reflect this awe of women and what they were able to do with their bodies.
Yeah, I guess the first sculptures were of these goddess figures, these large-breasted women. Some of them were pregnant, and they were actually scattered around the Western world. So they were worshipped. That's speculation, but the thought is that they might have been worshipped.
And I like that you write in that part of your book that God used to be a mother who worked outside the home. I thought that was an interesting idea.
So it's been a regression. And then maybe, hopefully, we're catching up with our goddesses.
So explain that, though. Explain what you meant when you said God used to be a mother who worked outside the home.
Well, I this is speculation, but in pre-literate history, these figures were often female, and they were often pregnant. So the assumption would be that they were worshipped, and so they had women had a very high status because they could do this miraculous thing, give birth, and so you can arguably the status of women and mothers was really high. But then, in the course of history, they got tied to the home, and that ceased to have a whole lot of status, and men went out there. Men went out to the fields, and women were consigned to the domestic sphere.
Right.
So that could be arguably a loss of status, depending on your point of view. But they weren't outside the home working.
And you also talk about how, while, like you say, it's speculative and we don't know for certain, the fact that we are here today as Homo sapiens says something about what our historical mothers felt was important, right? That tending to infants was of importance, and like why they did that is sort of in question. But you had some ideas about that. What do you believe?
This is so. This is a very. What you're asking is there a natural instinct to mother?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I guess an ancillary question would be: do men have that instinct to parent? And it's a very difficult thing to answer. Mother love is very romanticized. The reality is, if you want your children, then I think there's a lot of mother love and father love. But until women could choose to have babies, they didn't automatically love them. And unwanted babies are not necessarily loved. In fact, they might be hated. So it's hard to. It's hard to say whether there's a natural instinct. Mother love is a natural instinct. Same thing with father love.
Mm-hmm.
And this is gone. I mean, when children were a burden, when there was not enough food to go around, I mean, there was a large incidence of the killing of babies, of infant babies. In ancient Greece, babies were killed, certainly in the Middle Ages. Children were not wanted. They were gotten rid of. It's a sad history. Another theory about it is that because so many children died in infancy, that might have affected people's attachment to their baby. Another thing is that so many women died in childbirth. Mm-hmm. So until childbirth became a safe procedure, I mean, women wouldn't want to have children, I mean, because they'd want to die.
Right, like this idea that if you're having multiple births in your lifetime, and if each time it's of great risk to you, and then if you make it through, infant mortality rate in some periods of time was very high, higher than 50%.
Right. Yeah.
You know, how attached would a person, a mother or a father, get to any infant, given that...
All of that is questioned, yes.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned ancient Greece. So let's fast forward through time a little bit to ancient Greece. You mentioned that, you know, at first we had people, people were not living sedentary lives in a particular spot. They were hunters, gatherers. In that scenario, women were not just having babies in this awesome way, people didn't necessarily know that men were responsible for it as well. But they also were gathering, you know, up to 80% of the sustenance of whatever it is that their collective groups were eating. So they maybe had somewhat of a status. They had status within their group that was related in some ways to that, and we don't fully understand that. Then, you know, farming comes along, and so women in nurturing children goes from a gathering kind of way where kids presumably could kind of run around the females as they're gathering in a field or wherever it is in the forest, to a farm type setting where, you know, now there's sort of a household or a place that's inside and sedentary and in one spot where families are happening and children are being raised. So you mentioned in ancient Greece that there is evidence of they called, I'm not seeing my notes here, it's the... What was it called?
Infanticide?
Well, yeah, but it was called something else. Exposure. That's what it was, right?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so tell us, you know, it goes into parenting. It's a difficult topic to talk about because no one likes to think about babies just being left out. But this is something that was happening during those times, was it not?
Well, certainly in Sparta. But the answer to that is yes, and that it was very tied to gender. I mean, males were preferred over females, and then healthy. People wanted healthy babies, the body beautiful, ancient Greece. And there was infanticide. I mean, people killed babies. People killed babies for many centuries. I don't think we like to think about that. But
no, yeah.
I mean, when there wasn't a lot of food going around and it became very desperate, people committed infanticide. So that all makes one question whether there is, if it's a natural instinct to love your child. And these are not our values, but ancient times didn't share our values.
So you mentioned that male babies were preferred. Can you explain that? What do we know about that? Why?
Well, I mean, I this is again speculation, but with the onset of patriarchy, with men becoming dominant, I mean, they became preferred as children, and women were, the female gender was, they were devalued.
You know,
I mean, there were also social class things going on. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about ancient Greece, we're really talking about the wealthy ancient Greeks.
Right. That's who we know about. Right. And so just describe for us also, because I know you go into this in your book, a little bit about what might it look like if you were a wealthy Greek woman? What might your life be like?
You were a citizen woman.
Right.
You might. For one thing, I think that there was... heterosexuality was not the norm, so that at that point in history, there is evidence to show that the highest form of sex was between a citizen man and a boy. So, I mean, which I think is interesting for the status of women. So having heterosexual sex was not as valued as this adult male with a younger male person. And so I think that indicates something about the status of women in ancient Greece and the status of parenthood. I mean, it mattered if you were a slave or a citizen.
And you also write in your book that that a citizen woman, her value is seen in giving birth to the male child, and but that there wasn't necessarily value put in the raising of that male child.
This is true. And I mean, I'm not sure, or the thinking is that the women actually didn't really raise the children, that education was performed by teachers. And there were wet nurses employed to feed the child. It wasn't necessarily the mother, the biological mother. Wet nursing was just a common thing throughout history, mm-hmm. even into the 20th century.
And so, you know, this conversation also very naturally leads into a question of childhood. Like, when did childhood become childhood as we know it? Because it hasn't always been the case that the idea of childhood
has been
the same.
Yeah, people, well, I mean, I guess it's a luxury to have childhood, especially adolescence. So that was probably fairly recent history. So you were a child until you were fertile and sexually active, and then you were an adult. So, so adolescence didn't really exist, I guess, until maybe some people say the 18th century. I mean, it was an economic thing. It was a way of thinking. It was a luxury.
It's a really interesting idea that adolescence is a luxury of our time.
It is an interesting idea. When you read Dickens, you can sort of see it. You know,
right.
These people who did not have an opportunity to be.
Yes, and through policy, you know, we have strict rules on how old someone has to be before they can work outside the home, and so on and so forth. But, you know,
I was way younger. Years
ago. Right. Like, it hasn't been so far removed that, you know, many people were kind of considered adults at a very young age, in early teens, and, you know, had to work. This is Kids These Days. Today we're talking about the myths of motherhood. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and author and psychologist Shari L. Thurr is speaking with me this hour. Now I think it's time, since we're talking about teens, to play this. Last month, news about teens becoming mothers made headlines. The number of teen pregnancies in the United States dropped to a record low for the U.S. According to a CDC report, teen birth rates for 15 to 17-year-olds fell 12% from 2009 to 2010. Birth rates for 18 and 19-year-olds dropped 9%, though rates in the U.S. are still significantly higher than in other industrialized countries. In Alaska, teen birth rates have been on the decline since the early 1990s, dropping by 42% for younger moms and 24% for older moms over a 15-year period. Older teens have almost four times as many children as younger teens, and Alaska Native teens have children at about 2.5 times the rate of non-natives. For many of those younger teens who become pregnant, finishing high school is the biggest challenge. In Anchorage, some of them attend Crossroads, a high school just for pregnant and parenting teens. Some of them are also enrolled in KidCorps Early Head Start program. The program has an in-home element that offers child developmental information, developmental screening, and just general support to those young moms who are some as young as 13 years old. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran spoke to the woman who does those home visits, Tundra Paulson.
Well, Tundra, thanks so much for speaking with us today. I really just wanted to ask you about what your job is. So you go and visit families at their home and help them with what?
We do weekly home visits, and they last typically around anywhere from an hour, hour and a half to 2 hours. And what I do is we go over child development. We have a piece where we do a parent-child interaction activity. We go over parenting topics, like hot topics, like potty training, positive discipline, redirection. We also go over, we do a little literacy activity every visit. And that would be, you know, for the young infants reading a book to the older toddler who is actually guessing what the picture is saying. We do health screenings. You know, we go over well baby checks, their shots, making sure everything is up to date. We do some resource referrals for the families. We also do goal setting, and we do follow-ups. And then we also do developmental screenings, vision and hearing screenings. We do height and weight, all for the children.
Okay. And so you do this for children starting around age 4 months? Is
prenatal.
That what I saw?
Prenatal.
Oh, all the okay. So prenatal yeah. up until what age?
3 years.
Okay. And so when you, it sounds like you have some things kind of prepared for when you go. And so I guess I'm trying to understand how much of it is sort of a prepared agenda that you maybe have going in, and how much of it is what kinds of questions parents have or things that they bring up when you're there.
Okay, so the what I do get prepared is the parent-child activity, and it's anything that the parent suggests that they want to work on. Like if they want to work on their baby's fine motor, then I'm going to bring, you know, an activity for the parent and child to work on together. A lot of the home visit that's not planned is the family or the parent time where parents are asking questions for referrals for like heating assistance or rental assistance or transportation issues. And it's just going through what Anchorage has to offer or the community has to offer these young families.
You mentioned that you do goal setting and follow up with the parents. Can you maybe give me an example of a goal that that a parent set that you then follow up with?
For the younger girls or the younger parents, a lot of their goals their goal is all the same, and it's graduating. And what I do with that is, you know, we set up a goal for graduation and a timeline. Like if they're a freshman in high school, how are they going to graduate by the time they are a senior? So we'll break it down in years. Like, okay, so the freshman year you need so many credits, and how are you going to get those credits? What can I help you with to achieve your freshman year? Basically, we'll take it a year at a time. We'll make sure that they're attending classes. I collaborate a lot with the high school that they do go to and the teachers there, and we make sure that they have passing grades, and if they're maybe failing in English, then I would help them find a tutor or, you know, just basically ask them what their needs are and why is this a challenge and how we can overcome that challenge.
Okay. So it sounds like it's like a little bit of maybe parent coaching. You were talking about,
yes.
You know, doing the activity and sort of, mm-hmm. you know, pointing out, oh, this might be what your child is wanting right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit of helping them facilitate their lives.
Right. Yep, that's what I do.
Okay. And so a lot of that must have to do with being able to build a rapport with these families.
Like the most important piece right there is building that trusting relationship with these families. And it's a little bit harder with the younger parents, just because they're not really sure if I'm judging them or if I'm feeling some sort of way because they're a teen parent. But once they realize that, you know, I'm not judging. I'm providing information and not my own opinions with them. And I'm non-judgmental. Then they open up a lot. And
do you have any funny stories about that, or just kind of, you know, stories about, where you were maybe feeling frustrated or feeling some resistance and then finally sort of got through and got to that point of trust?
I know this one time I was meeting with a particular young mom, and another young mom, you know, walked into the room, and they were, you know, and I was giving her suggestions about reading baby's cues, and you know, the other young mom was like, well, that ain't going to work, and just totally trying to be a bully, you know, kind of like everything I'm saying is wrong. And the young woman that I was meeting with was like, oh, well, maybe, you know. And, you know, they were getting pretty mean, and I had to be like, okay, you know what, we're going to stop this right now. I was like, I'm here for you. You know, I just had to reassure her, like, I'm here for you. I'm not here to lead you wrong or to give you wrong information, and let's kind of regroup. Let's do this again. So, I mean, that was kind of, that was really frustrating and really hard for me to not just get up and walk out, you know, like, okay, well, I don't need to be here, you know, that sort of thing. And then sometimes the younger moms, you know, they're constantly looking for reassurance and looking for that support that they may not get at home or that they don't have. And, like, I'll get text messages all day, like, oh, I want to buy a new cell phone. What kind do you think I should get? Or, oh, I found these really cool jeans. Those type of things.
You said that, you just said that, you know, they're looking for that support that they maybe don't have somewhere
right.
else in their lives. Is that true for a lot of the younger parents that you work with, that they, I mean, it's almost like they've become parents, but they're still looking for a parent for themselves?
Yeah, it is. It's, that's, you know, one thing I still haven't really found an answer for, but it seems like as soon as these young girls have children, it's like their parents are kind of not around for them. They're more worried about, like, the grandchild. And it seems like they totally forget about their own child. And that's kind of hard, really hard to deal with. And so that's something I don't understand why that happens.
Well, Tondra Paulson, thanks so much for talking to us on Kids These Days today.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tondra Paulson is the in-home visitor for Kids Corps Early Head Start program in Anchorage. She spoke with Kids These Days, Jessica Cochran. You're tuned into Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and we're talking about myths of motherhood today in a special Mother's Day edition. I'm on with my guest author and psychologist, Shari Elther, and she's joining us from Boston. And Shari, I'm wondering, you know, how... First of all, do you have any reaction to the piece we just heard? And then second of all, is the ideas that we have today about teen mothering, you know, how far back do those go in history? How much are they a part of a long history or a short history?
First of all, I think it sounds like a terrific program. And clearly, I mean, I think sometimes young people have children in order that the children love them. I mean, I think that people have babies looking for love from the baby. They're vicariously identifying with the baby, as receiving love in an odd way. So, I think parenting is a very difficult. It's a lot of hard work, and the more support people have in parenting, I think it's great. I mean, in Europe, these kind of programs are built in even for middle-class parents and older parents. It's just parents in general receive much more governmental support, daycare and people coming to their home in England and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the second part of it is how do we evaluate? Well, people formerly had children at a much younger age. I think the age at which people are having children is getting older, and maybe. And the birth rate, as you mentioned before, is falling. So I hopefully that's out of an awareness that this is a very important job that requires maturity and you know, it's an economic decision. And so we do think differently about teenage pregnancy. Mm-hmm. It was more typical years ago than it is now.
Yes, now it's something that people try actively to prevent.
And, well, you know, there are many reasons for that, and some of them sound.
Mm-hmm. This is Kids These Days. You're listening to us on listener-supported radio across Alaska. Hello there in Kodiak, Juneau, Dillingham, Haines, Skagway, and Klukwan, Chivac, and Anchorage in the Mat-Su. Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. We're distributed by the Alaska Public Radio Network, and we record our show in the studios of KSKA-FM in Anchorage, thanks to all our broadcast partners. Still to come this hour, I continue the conversation with Shari L. Thurer about the history of motherhood and how, as she describes through her writing, cultures and eras reinvent what good mothering is. That and lots more still to come. Stay with us. We'll be back after a quick break. Being overweight or obese is a serious health issue in Alaska. 36% of adults are too heavy, and our kids are getting heavier all the time. Recent increases in overweight children are the highest in Alaska's kindergarten and elementary-aged kids. So next time on Kids These Days, we're talking about obesity and its complications for individuals and communities. Tune in for that conversation and our reporting on healthy, statewide local food initiatives, as well as practical advice for parents about getting the whole family more active. Join us. We're back. You're listening to a special Mother's Day edition of Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and my guest today is author and psychologist Shari L. Thurer. She's sharing with us a history of motherhood and the changing expectations that have gone along with the job for centuries. So I'd like to ask you about something I found really interesting in your book, Shari. You talk about the time at which, historically, children emerge as people that we see as children. For a lot of early history, when children are portrayed, they're portrayed as like little adult-looking people. So they're just smaller versions yes. with adult proportions and so forth. But then at some point, we start to see children and we start to see them look like children. Can you tell us about that? What was happening
in
what period of time?
It's so interesting in art, because if you saw early, before the Renaissance, portrayals of Jesus Christ, for instance, he was portrayed as a little man, not as a baby. Mm-hmm. And that evolved with the evolution of thinking that there are stages in life and that they're real. And I guess some historians have argued that childhood is an invention that sort of came later, that it took... and the ideas of how to raise a child came later in history with the development of the Reformation and the idea of a family and so forth and so on. So certainly the idea of adolescence, as we talked about before, mm-hmm. is a much later thought.
Right. So it's in the 1600s, right, that children are starting to show up in art. Is that correct?
As children, after the Renaissance, okay. probably before the Reformation, yeah.
Okay, and so yeah. where is it that we start to see them for the first time? And what kind? You said in religious art, is that what you were saying?
Well, in art history, I think that most of the painting for many years was biblical in nature. And so you look, if you look at the evolution of the portrayal of Mary and the portrayal of Jesus, I mean, that evolved over time. And eventually, during the Renaissance, Jesus became a baby, and the Madonna became a three-dimensional woman, often very beautiful. And that was a time, and she became very, and over history, she became more and more important in religion. And so I think motherhood was elevated, or the idealization of motherhood was elevated with the elevation of the figure of Mary.
Mm-hmm. And you write in particular about the Virgin Mary, that she's not just elevating the status of motherhood, but she sort of starts to embody the idea of a perfect mother.
Yeah, that's the downside, was that Mary was portrayed as all giving, all virtuous. She didn't even have sex. You know, she wasn't like a natural woman. So that's a very high standard. She was all loving and all for her son. So it's been hard to keep up with that level of expectation for moms, I guess.
That sounds like that's maybe, we're talking about trends, and maybe that's one trend that we can trace back a very long way.
Yes, to the Virgin Mary,
to living up to that as a model for what to expect. I also like that you, and you just mentioned it just a minute ago, but that Christianity also raises the status of babies, because after all, Jesus was himself a baby at one point in time. It unravel that a little bit for us. So, I take that to mean that before Jesus, maybe babies weren't even on the radar, so to speak.
Well, that's speculative, and I think that certainly wanted children were wanted throughout history. But when it wasn't such a controllable act, having a child, I think people had very mixed feelings about it. But certainly with the depictions of Jesus and the Madonna and his idea of being deified or God, elevated the status of childhood and a baby. Mm-hmm. And especially later on, after he was portrayed, first, as we know, he was portrayed as a little man, and then he became a baby in the paintings and sculpture. So, I think babyhood was acknowledged and maybe elevated.
And so let's talk about how the emergence of the nuclear family affects childhood and parenting. So, you know, at points throughout history, as we're moving, you know, along this continuum of how families are happening, and this is in Western culture, at some point, you know, a communal setting where there are families and servants and people who work the fields, and they're all kind of living communally, this wasn't a nuclear family. This was another kind of situation. But then eventually we end up in a nuclear family situation where we have families, mother, father, children, living in a home. And how did this affect parenting in your research?
Yes. Okay. It's so interesting to think about life before there were nuclear families, because I think so many of us think they were eternal. And but if you really look back at even biblical history, they really people had multiple wives, and there wasn't this idea of a mom and dad and kids. Prior to the development of the nuclear family, a lot of things were economic. So the serfs probably didn't even marry. And marriage wasn't considered a romantic thing. A lot of it was, for the upper classes, was economic. And those folks would have children, and those children would be wet nursed. It was this, the idea of a nuclear family probably occurred with the Reformation, and you can see it in Dutch painting, where there are ordinary home scenes. But in earlier Renaissance paintings, you didn't see a nuclear family. Hmm. It sort of interesting to think about. We take things so for granted.
It is interesting to think about. I like that you mentioned it, that so many people just sort of assume it was always that way. You know, I have to say, like, even though I've seen depictions of life, you know, in a abbey or communal type setting, I never really thought about how that of, you know, I guess I always imagined that the nuclear family was within that as a nuclear family.
Well, and you know, you can look at architecture and see that in ancient times there was no privacy. People had communal beds. Privacy was a luxury, and the way houses were built. And so then there wasn't really marriage in a lot, and marriage was pretty late onset. Christian marriage, you know, I think they, it evolved out of Roman ceremonies, but I mean, in really ancient times, things were very different.
And so
there wasn't a nuclear family,
right? And so the emergence of the nuclear family, and you know, life more as we today feel familiar with
and value things.
Yes,
yeah.
And value things. You know, there's been all sorts of trends that have come and gone throughout, say, you know, just the 1900s and now into the 21st century, right? Like you talked about in the very beginning of this program that when you were raising your child, you know, it was what was in vogue was being the empathetic mom. And, you know,
now I'm talking about for educated Northeastern women. That was the norm.
Was an
expectation, yeah.
In the particular place where you were. So tell, I'd just like to know in general, like, what some of these norms were in recent history, you know.
Yeah. Now, I think it's gone in two different directions. There's this method called attachment parenting, where you keep the child in bed with you for many years, and you wear the child, your child on a sling around you for a long period of time, and so that's one trend. I think another thing that seems to be happening now that wasn't so present in my socioeconomic group 30 years ago or 20 years ago was expectations now, norms and achievement and being programmed to get into a good school. That's emphasized in many circles. So there's limit setting and higher expectations. There's the tiger mom, for instance. And well, and the French mom.
I know that's a very recent development.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Actually,
and tiger mom, I mean.
Right. And speaking of French moms, there's recently been a book called The Conflict, How Modern Motherhood Undermines the Status of Women. This is by an author, Elizabeth Badinter. She's started a big storm. And you know, an overview of what she's writing about is women are overburdened and consumed, this is her belief, with unrealistic expectations of maternal perfection to their own personal and professional detriment. Badinter argues this convincingly, and in some circles, babies are expected to be strapped to their parents' bosoms for the first 6 months of life, fed organic homemade baby food, and taught Mandarin as they toddle around in their diapers. And anything artificial is rejected as bad, even if things like that would make life dramatically easier. And almost all of this additional labor required to adhere to these impossible new standards falls on the shoulders of women. I thought that was interesting.
I essentially agree with her, but yeah. I mean, I'm for choice. If women want to do this, that's great. And if they're more interested in career and other things outside the home, I'm for that too.
I thought it was interesting, since this is something that's very, very current, something that just, you know, a book that was just recently published and released, and people are talking about it now, and you know, on the internet and all over the place. But it really rung, it was particularly connected to something that you said in your book as well, that standards for domestic excellence have increased while most moms are in the workforce, but then they're still responsible for a higher level of domestic tranquility. So, you know, can you explain why? You know, that's what's happening now, and it's continuing to happen. So do you have any answers for why that's continuing to happen?
Well, I think anxiety. I mean, I think people are very worried about being a good parent and getting your child into Harvard, and it seems to fall on the women. Actually, I think men are more in the act right now, at least in the area where I live and my patients. And Elizabeth Badinter wrote the same book about 20 years before. So it's interesting to me. I don't know why it's, maybe she rewrote it or something, and why it's taken on popularity now, because I remember, I wrote my book years ago and I remember citing her. Anyway, I think it's, the expectations for women are very high. I think guys are getting in the act now, and I see a lot more participation, and things are changing. And also, nowadays, unlike 20 years ago, women are free to complain about parenting, which was very much a taboo. And now you can find all these blogs and things on the internet, sort of bemoaning the tediousness of it all. I mean, people love it, but they're freer to say they hate it, which was a very forbidden thing. So I think some things have gotten better, more honest. The fact that men are participating more, and the fact that women are freer to be real about their feelings, and the fact that they're not so very much blamed for mental illness. I think all of those things are positive in the present world.
And that goes back to what you were saying about how now that there's more attention to genetics, some of the burden for how a child turns out has been taken off of blaming the mother for that outcome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the 60s, mothers were blamed for schizophrenia and for autism. It's hard to believe, but I mean, there was something called the refrigerator mom, in theory, that the mother that was so cold and gave her child mixed signals, so it was her fault her child was autistic.
Oh my gosh, really?
Really, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it sort of died that thinking died maybe in the 70s, but it was there before.
Well, this is Kids These Days, and this hour I'm talking with Shari L. Thurer. She's joining us from Boston. She's an author and a psychologist. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this is a Mother's Day episode of Kids These Days. Parenting is often described as one of life's most rewarding jobs. It's also a huge stress inducer, especially when parents work outside the home and juggle the competing demands of job and family. Parents are increasingly looking for coping methods and solutions to make it all work. Kids These Days contributor Paula Dobbin spoke to three mothers who rely on meditation and yoga to find balance.
Karen Mason Miller used to work 60 to 80 hour weeks when she owned a marketing and public relations firm in Texas. Childless at the time, Miller was married to a man who also put in long hours, and their lives largely revolved around work. As she approached her fourth decade, Miller felt something was deeply missing.
It was a good job, and I worked with great people, but it was numbingly unfulfilling. I mean, it was what you call a job, you know, it was a work. It was drudgery.
Soon after this realization, Miller's marriage ended. She began to experience insomnia and depression. Nothing really seemed to help. One day, she was walking through her house and noticed a book on her shelf that she didn't remember purchasing. It was titled The Tao Te Ching, an ancient book of Chinese wisdom. She pored through the book's teachings, and it would prove to be a turning point.
And I just picked it up, and I didn't even know how to pronounce the name on the book, you know? But I read it, and it was so beautiful and true and rich, and I felt like I'd heard a gong.
The PR executive started practicing yoga and meditation, and before long, her life changed dramatically. She took a trip to Europe by herself. She met a new man, fell in love, and remarried. Before long, an offer came from someone asking if they could buy her company. She accepted, moved to California, and had a baby at age 42. Miller's now 55 and a stay-at-home mother. She's also a Buddhist priest and an author of two books about how parenting and routine household chores can provide powerful opportunities for insight.
To keep a house functioning, you know, to keep our bodies healthy, we engage constantly, over and over again, in behaviors that are routine. And what I really like to suggest to people is not that they just replace a negative connotation with a positive connotation, but that they no longer judge anything in their lives as being entertaining or not entertaining, fulfilling or not fulfilling, you know, drudgery or beauty. It's just how it is. And when you do things that need to be done that are obvious and apparent right in front of you without resisting them or judging them. When you just do them, the beauty is revealed automatically.
Miller's first book is called Mama Zen, Walking the Crooked Path of Motherhood. Her second is titled Hand Wash Cold, Instructions for an Ordinary Life. She uses laundry as a metaphor for how enlightenment can be found in the seemingly mundane. Granted, she doesn't have to punch a time clock or work 9 to 5 these days, and she lives in Southern California, not in Alaska, where winter lasts 8 months of the year, if not longer. But no one has to quit their job, move to a sunny climate, or sit on a meditation cushion to benefit from what Miller espouses, says Diana Winston, mother of a toddler and a former Buddhist nun who teaches meditation at the University of California, Los Angeles. Winston has also published 2 books on meditation, Fully Present, The Science, Art, and Practice of Mindfulness, and Wide Awake, A Buddhist Guide for Teens. For Winston, finding relief from the stresses of parenting is really quite simple.
In the course of the day, that's one thing I'm doing. I'm often just noticing. I'm noticing what's going on in my mind. And then if I'm noticing that I'm off balance, that I'm anxious, I'm just stopping and taking a breath. There's a wonderful little practice that we teach in our meditation classes called STOP. And it stands for Stop, Take a Breath, Observe, and Proceed. And it just means when you notice that you're needing it, essentially, that you need a moment, respite, you might stop, but you don't have to freeze or something, just stop that flow of the thoughts by taking a breath. And you take a breath, eyes open or closed, and then observe what's happening internally for me right now.
Let's open up the foil, and then you just stick the butter knife in there. Not too hard. Is it soft on the inside?
On a recent afternoon, Kim Grief was baking sweet potatoes with her 12-year-old in the kitchen of their Sand Lake home in Anchorage.
Another 10 minutes?
Maybe 3?
3 minutes? Okay, let's put it back in.
Besides being a mother, Grief is also an artist and the owner of Laughing Lotus, a yoga studio in Anchorage. For more than a decade, Grief has used yoga and meditation to help meet the demands of parenting and running a business. Sometimes it means simply taking a breath and making a mental shift.
Yoga's taught me a lot of discipline and boundaries within myself. And so, you know, an example of how that plays into my life is that I have this rule that when I'm coming down the road, if I hit Sand Lake Road, which is, you know, a mile away from my house, that's when I shift gears. As soon as I hit Sand Lake, I know it's time to turn off whatever I have going on in the workplace, and it's time to switch gears and show up for my family, so that if I'm hungry or if I'm tired, I'm walking through the door knowing that I'm going to show up and be the best that I can possibly be for my husband and for my son.
Sometimes the shift doesn't happen right at the Sand Lake intersection. Grief says she'll sit in the car for a while and use breath awareness to center herself before entering the home. The technique can also be used when anger arises.
The other morning, this new puppy peed on the floor, and I knew it was going to happen. I was, you know, racing to get myself ready, Ethan ready for school, and when it was happening, I just yelled. I yelled at the puppy, and Ethan thought it was him. He thought it was his responsibility to be watching the dog, and after I realized, oh, I can put the puppy in the crate, it's okay, clean up the mess. And that's when I took the time to go, wow, I reacted really quickly in this explosive way. And that's when I get to clean it up with Ethan too, and let him know that it's nothing that he did. And we often talk about big emotional reactions pretty soon afterwards.
Author Karen Mazin Miller says acknowledging your mistakes as a parent and saying sorry to your children is an important aspect of being a spiritually minded parent. She says the humility and compassion that one develops through a spiritual practice like meditation can be liberating for both parents and children.
You can say you're sorry. You can take a situation in which, you know, you've really mishandled it, you've created difficulty, you know, you've scared somebody. And I like to use with children, I really think we scare them more often than we might actually harm them. But we scare them with our outbursts. You know, and we can immediately resolve that just by atoning for what we've done.
Forgiveness helps, while holding on to anger and living in a stressed-out emotional state is harmful to both parents and children, Miller says. All three mothers agree that even people who don't meditate or do yoga can find relief from parenting stress by simply taking a breath, watching their thoughts, and pausing before reacting. For Kids These Days, I'm Paula Dobbin.
And I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this is Kids These Days, and today we're talking about mothering, and my guest, Shari Elther, joins me from Boston. Shari, I'd like to invite you to comment on that piece we just heard by Paula.
Well, I applaud taking a breath. I think that's a great thing. I tend not to, and I think yoga and relaxation can be very helpful and calming and soothing. And Buddhism, you know, it helps us question our values, and it can be very positive, I think. I tend to be more, I think the term mindfulness has become a pop term, a fan, and I tend to be more intellectual than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems so simplistic to me, but I'm a fan of relaxing.
And as a psychologist, you know, I feel like this idea that any emotional outburst is unacceptable in a family, and that somehow by having an occasional mix-up like that, you're going to do harm to your child. I mean, is that something we as parents need to worry about?
I think we have to acknowledge what we're feeling, and you can't deny anger when it's there, or anxiety when it's there. I think you should sense it in yourself, think about it, and not necessarily act on it, but you can't deny that things are maddening or pleasant, and when they're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm for reality, but not acting in it. And I don't think one outburst or is going to be all that harmful for your children. I mean, the children have to know when discipline is important. Limit setting is important. Undue anger, and certainly acting on undue anger, is bad. But children know when you're withholding your feelings. I mean, my daughter can read she can tell what I'm thinking by the way I breathe on the telephone. I mean, so.
That's a great place to leave it. I want to thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. Shari Elther is the author of The Myths of Motherhood, How Culture Reinvents the Good Mother. She joined us today from Boston, where she lives and works. Thank you so much, Shari.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And one last thought. Shari Elther says in her book, by unmasking the myths of motherhood, we can enlarge the possibility for taking control through education, public policy, psychotherapy, even moral preachment, to achieve the climate that we desire. At the societal level, child rearing would not be dismissed as an individual mother's problem, but one in which nurturance and the well-being of all children are transcendent public priority. In other words, it takes a village to raise a child. Like each and every week, we'll link you to Shari's work as well as other resources we mentioned throughout the hour. You can find this full episode posted right now on our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. Throughout the week, we'll also make the individual pieces you hear this hour available there as well. Follow us online and through Facebook to see when new stuff is posted. Kids These Days had help today from Paula Dobbin, who reported from Anchorage. Jessica Cochran is our regular contributor and our technical editor. Sarah Gonzalez produces this program and is our business manager. She also manages, edits, and maintains our website. Lost Lander composed and performed our original theme music. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for joining me today, and I'll see you next time.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidsthesedays.org.